thanks very much. Well, my paper very much follows on from that last question and response that it deals with EU citizenship. And as I'm sure everybody here knows, you access EU citizenship through being a citizen of a member state. And many people see that as a unsatisfactory or transitionary aspect of that status, and that the destiny, as the Court of Justice has put it, of European citizenship is actually to become the main status of national citizens of member states. Through citizenship going beyond the state, either to some supranational status or some transnational status. Now, the reasons why that's thought to be necessary is because it's thought that in an interconnected world, there are problems of justice and efficiency which render such a move normatively necessary and justifiable. So, what I want to put to you here is that possibly there's a way of dealing with the issues that are rightly raised about the problems of citizenship in an interconnected world, but still see citizenship as being primarily located in nation states such as we know them today, with a status such as union citizenship as it is today, more or less, performing an important role to answer precisely those problems that people who argue it's got to be a transitionary, temporary move towards a fuller European citizenship put forward. And the reason, I think there are many reasons which might be appealing for taking this way, if I can convince you that it's a good way of understanding it. But one might, two might be the following, that even if you think that a transnational or supranational form of citizenship could work. Most people, even its advocates, accept that there are transitional costs and difficulties in getting there. And some of those transitional costs are obviously of a pragmatic kind. But one thinks that, unfortunately, the reaction to the EU in the UK is not alone throughout European states. And in part, it's because it's felt that a shift of power above the state is a move too far. So if you can deal with certain problems without having to apparently make such a transformation in people's allegiances, etc., that might be an advantage, at the very least. So I'm trying to sort of put this forward in this modest manner. I have immodest versions of the theory, but I'm trying to, for the sake of it, of getting you on the side, I'm trying to be modest here. So the argument that, the normative value that I put forward in this account is one based on the Republican conception of non-domination. Non-domination being a form of relational equality in which no agent or agency is in a position to determine or influence the choices of another agent or agency without consulting their interests and reasoning or deliberating with them to rationally alter their views or to reach mutual accommodations. Now, I think that account of attractions for me anyway of that value is that it captures many of the worries that people have about this issue. I think it also is important because I think it captures what is distinctive, I think, about citizenship, which is that it's a political status to a degree. There are now some accounts of citizenship which try to conceive it. I mean, in some ways, Olivier's account fell into this camp. In juridical, legal terms, as a status which is defined through being the possessor of rights. But anyone can conceive that sort of view as being a form of subjecthood. I mean, perhaps a good form of subjecthood. But you know, if you think, could you have a constitutional legal order with minimal, perhaps no democracy, and still say that people were citizens? And what sort of order would that be? I mean, example that comes to mind when I'm trying to think what it might be. It might be the Imperial Germany before the First World War, for example, was a constitutional state in many respects, but it wasn't a democratic state in many respects, and it had therefore subjects rather than citizens. And so I think that not to be dominated is to have some control of the character of the constitutional order, and not even if a constitutional order can play a role in limiting domination through constraining how power is exercised. But the terms under which those constraints are set, I think, have to be subject to some kind of democratic control, or to sort of say that non-domination is achieved. And so citizenship is an important part of that. So the starting point then is that you can have states that meet a certain threshold in establishing conditions for non-domination through having working democratic and constitutional arrangements. And yet, in an interconnected world, it's possible that their citizens might be dominated by the citizens of other states. Their democratic decisions made in one state may impact in a way which meets my conditions of what creates domination. They're non-deliberative, they affect their decisions without consulting their interests of another state. And therefore, you can have wealthier, or larger, or more military powerful states influencing in non-deliberative ways and dominating small, poor, and weaker states. And this can operate in a whole series of ways through the exercise of economic power in particular, but as well as just military power. And global processes themselves can achieve this as well if they're affected through taking advantage of being able to locate production and distribution processes across a number of states. So it's often assumed, as I said at the beginning, that the only way in which you could tackle this problem of domination in an interconnected world would be if you scale up democracy in some way, or if you, in some senses, disperse sovereign power across various levels of governments. Thomas Poggi has famously advocated that solution. And the argument of this is often related to, you could relate this to what trilemma of the world economy. His trilemma is that it's impossible to simultaneously have democracy, national self-determination, and economic globalization. But this is something, somebody needs to send a postcard to Theresa May and tell her this. you can have two of these things. You can have, for example, national determination and democracy, have an autarkic state that most people would regard as being implausible. Or one could get rid of national self-determination and attempt, though this would be a major shift even for those who advocate it, except you could have globalization and some form of global democracy, perhaps. But you can't have national democracy and economic globalization, because one's going to undermine the other. Unless you accept in some way that there is going to be something that gives way. And one thing which might give way is globalization to national democracy. If it's possible that national democracies could cooperate in some way to collectively regulate what Danny Roderick calls smart globalization. And he argues in his book, Globalization Paradox, that Keynes's design of the Bretton Woods system achieved such a form for post-war period. And so, in some senses, what I'm trying to do here is provide a sort of normative account of what that sort of arrangement might involve. So, in this sort of arrangement, democratic states seek to overcome their problems by forming an association and regulating their interactions and those of other global processes which may be distinct from any state interaction in the making of the decisions that affect the collective life of the community of which you're a part. I think it does to some degree, but not entirely. There are three issues, and this is a sort of elaboration of what Reiner also mentioned at the beginning of his paper, that the theory of citizenship has to deal with. First is the issue of how you get included as a citizen of a given polity in the first place. Birth, an arbitrary criteria that unjustly advantages those born to wealthier polities, perhaps. Second, what about the impact of collective decisions of a given community of citizens on those who are excluded from citizenship of the polity? And particularly, isn't that particularly pertinent in the case of non-citizen residents, for example? And third, what about those who wish to leave or enter a political community? Shouldn't they have a right to freely move between states? Isn't the very fact that a state has borders which prevent some people moving into it a coercive, rendering them subject to the coercion of that? So here you have something where simply agreement between democratic states are not going to get rid of all of the issues which might relate to individuals being dominated in a world. So my response is that one way in which an association of democratic states of the kind that I describe might respond to these features of domination, because mine's a normative account, so it's not that the states want to do it simply for their self-interest, though I think they have interest in proceeding along these lines, but also to produce a justifiable international order, and to in which they, their own existence is also justifiable to other states and members of other states. So I think that they can tackle some of these issues by creating something very like union citizenship. So within this union, for example, the arbitrariness of birth into one country rather than another is in part mitigated by making it possible for the citizen of one country to have access to the labour market of another country. So someone from a poorer country with fewer labour possibilities can have access to a richer country where there are more such possibilities without being discriminated on the basis of their citizenship. It renders citizenship in that sense less arbitrary and less dominating. Or they can simply be allowed to move there. Yet, from the position that I'm adopting, but it's disputed by the transformative group, it would still remain acceptable to limit the access of those non-citizens to certain social and political rights of citizenship of the state to which they've moved, such as social benefits for non-workers or political rights to participate in national as opposed to local elections. Why is it those limitations recognise that citizens are, in a certain sense, those who are residing or were born there or are going to stay there, are seeking to shape the character of that polity in distinctive ways. And it's not that there is a best or correct way necessarily to shape it. So you couldn't sort of say, oh, you know, polity A is so much better than democratic polity B by some sort of external measure, because what renders them on this account legitimate and justified is that they've been shaped freely by their own citizens, but that they're also open to other citizens from other states coming there, so long as they respect the variety of ways if they become permanent presidents themselves they really are going to stay there, then I personally, I know Ryan disagrees with this, think that they have an obligation to naturalise in that country. Why? Because then the aspect of playing their part in the shaping of the society, and they themselves, almost like selling yourself into slavery, you become dominated permanently. It's something which rather surprised me through the tragedy of Brexit, but so many people that I know who have been living in the UK for 30-odd years from another European country have never taken out British citizenship or particularly wanted to vote in national elections. And I was surprised that these were all highly educated people, often highly political people. But that hadn't occurred. What about the one undeniably EU level right? That is a right which is supplied by the EU rather than is essentially something which leads to non-discrimination in getting a right which is provided within a member state, that of voting in the European Parliament. Another issue that we discussed today. Well, my scheme is obviously very much, it's intergovernmental, so it gives priority to the bodies like the European Council. It's also, because it's Republican, gives priority or a huge say to national parliaments. And I've written quite a lot on the role that they might be able to play and already do to some degree through changes to at Lisbon, and partly before that at Amsterdam. But even if you conceive the EU as essentially a delegated authority, there is a case for direct democratic control of how it works, particularly for those with an interest in free movement. But I think it does justify having what essentially are national-based constituencies, which lead to the overrepresentation of small countries and the role of national parties within them. So, what I've tried to suggest here to conclude is that EU citizenship has a rationale as being what it is, as being an international citizenship, rather than a form of supra- or transnational citizenship in the making, as many characterise it, and wrongly, I think. And that justifies many of the constraints that you find in the directives and in the treaties to a degree about the limits of Union citizenship, though it tends to be two steps forward, one step back, but also the European the Court of Justice of the EU has a tendency to always push to the limits the transnational or supranational aspects of it. Many people have seen this as being a transformative and positive view, whereas I'm sort of saying, well, if something gets lost here, the worth of national citizenship, without necessarily a clear normative gain, if I am correct suggesting that you can deal justifiably with some of the criticisms you might want to make of an exclusive national citizenship through this. I sort of have some final parochial Brexit-style reflections. I suppose I put this in because I've been very used, even though I sort of lived outside the UK for so long, but people always say, "You're so British in your view." And I even read the other day that somebody sort of saying that I must support Brexit. Well, I certainly don't, and never did. And in fact, the whole part of my argument is to sort of say, "Well, Brexit was won under the slogan 'Take back control,' but I think such a, something like the EU, you lose control. So it's a very pro-European agenda that I'm putting forward. But I think it's also one which says that one needs to deal with the issue of domination. And one aspect in which people can also be dominated is, of course, by these larger units. And you know, small is beautiful, and having a variety of units has a value in and of itself, its distinctiveness. So if one can find ways of dealing with those sorts of fears, which are some of which are based on prejudice, but some of which I think are normatively justifiable, then